From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Vampire of Caldenstein by Frederick Cowles. Since I was a lad, I have been accustomed to spending my vacations wandering about the more remote parts of Europe. I've had some pleasant times in Italy, Spain, Norway, and southern France. But of all the countries I have explored in this fashion, Germany is my favorite. It is an ideal vacation land for the lover of open-air life, whose means are small and tastes simple. For the people are always so friendly, and the inns are good and cheap. I've had many excellent vacations in Germany, but one will always stand out in my memory because of a very strange and remarkable experience which befell me. It was in the summer of 1933, and I had practically made up my mind to go on a cruise to the Canaries with Donald Young. Then he caught a very childish complaint, the measles, in fact, and I was left to make my own arrangements. The idea of joining an organized cruise without a companion did not appeal to me. I am not a particularly sociable kind of person, and these cruises seem to be one round of dances, cocktail parties, and bridge drives. I was afraid of feeling like a fish out of water, so I decided to forego the cruise. Instead, I got out my maps of Germany and began to plan a walking tour. Half the fun of a vacation is in the planning of it, and I suppose I decided on a particular part of the country and changed my mind half a dozen times. At first I liked the Moselle Valley, then it was the Lahn. I toyed with the idea of the Black Forest, swung over to the Harz Mountains, and then thought it might be fun to revisit Saxony. Finally I fixed upon southern Bavaria, because I had never been there and it seemed better to go and break fresh ground. 2 days of third-class travel is tiring even for a hardened globetrotter, and I arrived at Munich feeling thoroughly weary and sore. By some good chance, I discovered the Inn of the Golden Apple near the Hofgarten, where Peter Schmidt sells both good wine and good food, and has a few rooms for the accommodation of guests. Peter, who lived in Canada for 10 years and speaks excellent English, knew exactly how I was feeling. He gave me a comfortable room for 1 mark a night, served me with hot coffee and rolls, and advised me to go to bed and stay there until I was completely rested. I took his advice, slept soundly for 12 hours, and awakened feeling as fresh as a daisy. A dish of roast pork and 2 glasses of lager beer completed the cure, and I sallied forth to see something of Munich. The city is the 4th largest in Germany, and has much to interest the visitor. The day was well advanced, but I managed to inspect the Frauenkirche, with its fine stained glass, the old Rathaus, and the 14th-century church of St. Peter, near the Marienplatz. I looked in at the Regina Palast, where tea dance was in progress, and then went back to the Golden Apple for dinner. Afterward I attended a performance of Die Masked Singer at the National Theatre. It was past midnight when I retired to bed, and by then I had decided to stay in Munich for another day. I won't bore you with a description of the things I saw and did on the second day. It was just the usual round of sights with nothing out of the ordinary. After dinner, Peter helped me to plan my tour. He revealed a very intimate knowledge of the Bavarian villages and gave me a list of inns, which eventually proved invaluable. It was he who suggested I should take a train to Rosenheim and begin my walk from there. We mapped out a route covering about 200 miles and bringing me back to Munich at the end of 15 days. Well, to cut a long story short, I caught the early morning train to Rosenheim, and a deadly slow journey it was. It took nearly 3 hours to cover a distance of 46 miles. The town itself is quite a cheerful place of a small industrial type, with a 15th-century church and a good museum of Bavarian paintings housed in an old chapel. I did not linger there, but started off along the road to Traunstein, a pleasant road curving round the Chiem See, the largest lake in Bavaria. I spent the night at Traunstein, and the next day pushed on to the old walled city of Mulsdorf. From here I planned to make for Wiesenhofen by way of Farkirchen, but I took a wrong turning and found myself in a small place called Gankhofen. The local innkeeper tried to be helpful and directed me to a field path, which he said would prove a shortcut to Farkirchen. Evidently I misunderstood his instructions, for evening came, and I was hopelessly lost in the heart of a range of low hills which were not marked on any map. Darkness was falling when I came upon a small village, huddled under the shadow of a high cliff, upon which stood a grey stone castle. Fortunately the village possessed an inn, a primitive place but moderately comfortable. The landlord was an intelligent kind of chap, and friendly enough, although he informed me that visitors were seldom seen in the district. The name of the hamlet was Kaldensteen. I was served with a simple meal of goat's milk cheese, salad, coarse bread, and a bottle of thin red wine, and having done justice to the spread, went for a short stroll. The moon had risen, and the castle stood out against a cloudless sky like some magic castle in a fairy tale. It was only a small building, square with four turrets, but it was the most romantic-looking fortress I had ever seen. A light twinkled in one of the windows, so I knew the place was inhabited. A steep path and a flight of steps cut in the rock led up to it, and I half considered it paying the Lord of Kaldensteen a late visit. Instead, I returned to the inn and joined a few men who were drinking in the public room. The company was mainly composed of folk of the laboring class, and although they were polite, they had little of that friendly spirit one is accustomed to meet with in German villages. They seemed morose and unresponsive, and I had the impression that they shared some dread secret. I did my best to engage them in conversation without success. Then, to get one of them to speak, I asked, "Tell me, my friends, who lives in the castle on the hillside?" The effect of the harmless question upon them was startling. Those who were drinking placed their beer mugs on the table and gazed at me with consternation on their faces. Some made the sign of the cross, and one old chap hoarsely whispered, "Silence, stranger! God forbid that he should hear!" My inquiry seemed to have set them all together, and within 10 minutes they all left in a group. I apologized to the landlord for my indiscretion I had been guilty of, and hoped my presence had not robbed him of custom. He waved aside my excuses and assured me that the men would not have stayed long in any case. "They are terrified of any mention of the castle," he said, "and consider it unlucky to even glance at the building after nightfall." "But why?" I inquired. "Who lives there?" "It is the home of Count Ludwig von Kaldensteen." "And how long has he lived up there?" I asked. The man moved over to the door and carefully shut and barred it before he replied. Then he came over to my chair and whispered, "He has been up there for nearly 300 years. "Nonsense," I exclaimed, laughing. "How can any man, be he count or peasant, live for 300 years? "I suppose you mean that his family has held the castle for that length of time." "I mean exactly what I say, young man," answered the old fellow earnestly. "The count's family has held the castle for 10 centuries, and the count himself has dwelt in Burg Kaldensteen for 300 years. "But how can that be possible?" "He is a vampire. Deep down the castle rock are great vaults, and in one of these the count sleeps during the day so that the sunlight may not touch him. Only at night does he walk outside." This was too fantastic for anything, I am afraid. I smiled in a skeptical manner, but the poor landlord was obviously very serious, and I hesitated to make another remark that might wound his feelings. I finished my beer and got up to go to bed. As I was mounting the stairs, my host called me back and, grasping my arm, said, "Please, sir, let me beg you to keep your window closed. The night air of Kaldensteen is not healthy." On reaching my room, I found the window already tightly shut, although the atmosphere was like that of an oven. Of course, I opened it at once and leaned out to fill my lungs with fresh air. The window looked directly upon the castle, and in the clear light of the full moon, the building appeared more than ever like some dream of fairyland. I was just drawing back into the room when I thought I saw a black figure silhouetted against the sky on the summit of one of the turrets. Even as I watched, it flapped enormous wings and soared into the night. It seemed too large for an eagle, but the moonlight has an odd trick of distorting shapes. I watched until it was only a tiny black speck in the far distance. Just then, from far away, a dog howled weirdly and mournfully. Within a few moments, I was ready for bed, and disregarding the innkeeper's warning, I left the window open. I took my electric flashlight from my rucksack and placed it on the small bedside table, a table above which hung a wooden crucifix. I am usually asleep as soon as my head touches the pillow, but on this particular night I found it difficult to settle. The moonlight disturbed me, and I tossed about, vainly trying to get comfortable. I counted sheep until I was heartily sick of imagining the silly creatures passing through a gap in a hedge, but still sleep eluded me. A clock in the house chimed the hour of midnight, and suddenly I had the unpleasant feeling that I was no longer alone. For a moment I felt frightened, and then overcoming my fear I turned over. There by the window, and black against the moonlight, was the figure of a tall man. I start up in bed and grope for my flashlight. In doing so, I knocked something from the wall. It was a little crucifix, and my fingers closed over it almost as soon as it touched the table. From the direction of the window came a muttered curse, and I saw the figure poise itself on the sill and spring out into the night. In that brief moment, I noticed one other thing. The man, whoever he was, cast no shadow. The moonlight seemed to stream right through him. It must have been almost half an hour before I dared get out of bed and close the window. After that, I fell asleep immediately and slept soundly until the maid called me at 8 o'clock. In the broad daylight, the events of the night seemed too ridiculous to be true, and I decided that I had been the victim of some fantastic nightmare. In answer to the landlord's polite inquiry, I vowed I had spent a most comfortable night, although I am afraid my looks must have belied the statement. After breakfast, I went out to explore the village. It was rather larger than it had appeared on the previous evening, with some of the houses lying in a valley at the side of the road. There was even a small church, Romanesque in type, and sadly in need of repair. I entered the building and was expecting its gaudy high altar, when a priest came in through a side door. He was a lean, aesthetic-looking man, and at once gave me a friendly greeting. I returned his salutation and told him I was from England. He apologized for the obvious poverty of the building, pointed out some good 15th-century class, a carved font of the same period, and a very pleasing statue of the Madonna. Later, as I stood at the church door with him, I looked toward the castle and said, "I wonder, Father, if the Lord of Caldonstead will give me a welcome as friendly as the one I have received from you." "The Lord of Caldonstein," repeated the priest with a tremorous voice. "Surely you are not proposing to visit the castle." "That is my intention," I replied. "It looks a very interesting place, and I should be sorry to leave this part of the world without seeing it." "Let me implore you not to attempt to enter that accursed place," he pleaded. "Visitors are not welcomed at Caldonstein Castle. Besides that," he went on with a change in his voice, "there is nothing to see in the building." "What about the wonderful vaults in the cliff, and the man who has lived in them for 300 years?" I laughed. The priest's face visibly blanched. "Then you know the vampire," he said. "Do not laugh at evil, my son. May God preserve us all from the living dead." He made the sign of the cross. "Oh, Father," I cried, "surely you do not believe in such a medieval superstition." "Every man believes what he knows to be true, and we of Caldonstein can prove that no burial has taken place in the castle since 1645, when Count Feodor died and his cousin Ludwig from Hungary inherited the estate." "Such a tale is too absurd," I remonstrated. "There must be some reasonable explanation of the mystery. It is unthinkable that a man who came to this place in 1645 can still be alive." "Much is possible to those who serve the devil," answered the priest. "Always throughout the history of the world, evil has warred with good, and often triumph. Caldonstein Castle is the haunt of terrible, unnatural wickedness, and I urge you to keep as far away from it as you can." He bade me a courteous farewell, lifted his hand in a gentle benediction, and re-entered the church. Now, I must confess that the priest's words gave me a most uncomfortable feeling and made me think of my nightmare. Had it been a dream after all? Or could it have been the vampire himself, seeking to make me one of his victims and only being frustrated in his plan by my accidental gripping of the crucifix? These thoughts passed through my mind, and I almost abandoned my resolve to seek admittance to the castle. Then I looked up again at the gray old walls gleaming in the morning sunshine and laughed at my fears. No mythical monster from the Middle Ages was going to frighten me away. The priest was just as superstitious as his ignorant parishioners. Whistling a popular song, I made my way up the village street and was soon climbing the narrow path which led to the castle. As the ascent became steeper, the path gave place to a flight of steps, which brought me onto a small plateau before the main door of the building. There was no sign of life about the place, but a ponderous bell hung before the entrance. I pulled a rusty chain and set the crackling jangling. The sound disturbed a colony of rooks in one of the turrets and started them chattering, but no human being appeared to answer my summons. Again, I set the bell ringing. This time the echoes had hardly died away when I heard bolts being withdrawn. The great door creaked on its hinges, and an old man stood blinking in the sunlight. "Who comes to Castle Caldensee?" he asked in a curious, high-pitched voice, and I could see that he was half blind. "I'm an English visitor," I answered, "and would like to see the Count." "His Excellency does not receive visitors," was the reply, and the man made to close the door in my face. "But is it not permitted that I should see over the castle?" I asked hurriedly. "I am interested in medieval fortresses, and should be sorry to leave Caldensee without inspecting this splendid building." The old fellow peered out at me, and then a hesitant voice said, "There is little to see, sir, and I am afraid you would only be wasting your time." "Yet I would appreciate the privilege of a brief visit," I argued, "and I am sure the Count would not object. I do assure you I shall not be a nuisance, and I have no desire to disturb His Excellency's privacy." "What is the hour?" asked the man. I informed him that it was barely 11 o'clock. He muttered something about it being safe while the sun is in the sky, and motioned me to enter. I found myself in a bare hall, hung with rotting tapestry and smelling of damp and decay. At the end of the room was a canopied dais surmounted by a coat of arms. "This is the main hall of the castle," mumbled my guide, "and it has witnessed many great historic scenes in the days of the great lords of Caldensee. Here Frederick, the 6th Count, put out the eyes of 12 Italian hostages, and afterward had them driven over the edge of the cliff. Here Count August is said to have poisoned a prince of Wittenberg, and then sat at a feast with a dead body. He went on with his tales of foul and treacherous deeds, and it was evident that the Counts of Caldensee must have been a very unsavory lot. From the main hall he conducted me into a number of smaller rooms filled with moldering furniture. His own quarters were in the north turret, but although he showed me over the whole building, I saw no room in which his master could be. The old fellow opened every door without hesitation, and it seemed that except for himself, the castle was untenanted. "But where is the Count's room?" I inquired as we returned to the main hall. He looked confused for a moment, then replied, "We have certain underground apartments, and His Excellency uses one as his bedchamber. You see, he can rest there undisturbed." I thought that any room in the building would give him the quietness he required, without having to seek peace in the bowels of the earth. "And have you no private chapel?" I asked. "The chapel is also below." I intimated that I was interested in chapels, and should very much like to see an example of an underground place of worship. The old man made several excuses, but at last consented to show me the crypt. Taking an old-fashioned lantern from the shelf, he lit the candle in it, and lifting a portion of the tapestry from the wall, opened a hidden door. A sickly odor of damp corruption swept up at us. Muttering to himself, he led the way down a flight of stone steps and along a passage hollowed in the rock. At the end of this was another door which admitted us to a large cavern furnished like a church. The place stank like a charnel house, and the feeble light of the lantern only intensified the gloom. My guide led me toward the chancel, and lifting the light, pointed out a particularly revolting painting of Lazarus rising from the dead, which hung above the altar. I moved forward to examine it more closely, and found myself near another door. "And what is beyond this?" "Speak softly, sir," he implored. "It is the vault in which rest the mortal remains of the Lords of Caldensyn." And while he was speaking, I heard a sound from beyond the barrier, a sigh, and the kind of noise that might be made by a person turning in his sleep. I think the old servitor also heard it, for he grasped me with a trembling hand and led me out of the chapel. His flickering light went before him as I mounted the stairs, and I laughed sharply with relief as we stepped into the castle hall again. He gave me a quick look and said, "That is all, sir. You see there is little of interest in this whole building." I tried to press a 5-mark piece into his hand, but he refused to accept it. "Money is of no use to me, sir," he whispered. "I have nothing to spend it on, for I live with the dead. Give the coin to the priest in the village and ask him to say a mass for me, if you will. I promise it should be done as he desired," and then, in some mad spirit of bravado, asked, "And when does the Count receive visitors?" "My master never receives visitors," was the reply. "But surely he is sometimes in the castle itself. He doesn't spend all his time in the vaults," I urged. "Usually after nightfall he sits in the hall for an hour or so, sometimes walks in the battlements." "Then I shall be back tonight," I cried. "I owe it to His Excellency to pay my respects to him." The old man turned in the act of unfastening the door, and fixing his dim eyes upon my face, said, "Come not to Caldensyn after the sun has set, lest you find that which shall fill your heart with fear." "Don't try to frighten me with any of your hobgoblins," I rudely replied. Then raising my voice, I cried, "Tonight I shall wait upon the Count von Caldensyn." The servant flung the door wide, and the sunlight streamed into the moldering building. "If you come, he will be ready to receive you," he said. "And remember that if you enter the castle again, you do so of your own free will." By the time evening came, my courage had quite evaporated, and I wish I'd taken the priest's advice and left Caldensyn. But there's a streak of obstinacy in my makeup, and having vowed to visit the castle again, nothing could turn me from my purpose. I waited until dusk had fallen, and saying nothing to the innkeeper of my intentions, made my way up the steep path to the fortress. The moon had not yet risen, and I had to use my flashlight on the steps. I rang the cracked bell, and the door opened almost immediately. There stood the old servant, bowing a welcome. "His Excellency will see you, sir," he cried. "Enter Caldensyn Castle. Enter of your own free will." For 1 second I hesitated. Something seemed to warn me to retreat while there was still time. Then I plucked up courage and stepped over the threshold. A log fire was burning in the enormous grate, and gave a more cheerful atmosphere to the gloomy apartment. Candles gleamed in the silver candelabra, and I saw that a man was sitting at a table on the dais. As I advanced, he came down to greet me. How shall I describe the Count of Caldensyn? He was unusually tall, with a face of a natural pallor. His hair was intensely black, and his hands delicately shaped, but with very pointed fingers and long nails. His eyes impressed me most. As he crossed the room, they seemed to glow with a red light, just as if the pupils were ringed with flames. However, his greeting was conventional enough. "Welcome to my humble home, sir," he said, bowing very low. "I regret my inability to offer you a more hospitable welcome, but we live very frugally. It is seldom we entertain guests, and I am honored that you should take the trouble to call upon me." I murmured some polite word of thanks, and he conducted me to a seat at the long table upon which stood a decanter and one glass. "You will take wine," he invited, and filled the glass to the brim. It was a rare old vintage, but I felt a little uncomfortable at having to drink alone. "I trust you will excuse me for not joining you," he said, evidently noticing my hesitant manner. "I never drink wine." He smiled, and I saw that his front teeth were long and sharply pointed. "And now tell me," he went on, "what are you doing in this part of the world? Caldensyn is rather off the beaten track." and we seldom see strangers. I explained that I was on a walking tour and had missed my way to Pfarrkirchen. The Count laughed softly and again showed his fang-like teeth. "And so you came to Kaldestein, and of your own free will, you have come to visit me?" I began to dislike these references to my free will. The expression seemed to be a kind of formula. The servant had used it when I was leaving after my morning visit, and again when he had admitted me that evening, and now the Count was making use of it. "How else could I come but of my own free will?" I asked sharply. "In the bad old days of the past, many have been brought to this castle by force. The only guests we welcome today are those who come willingly." All this time, a queer tension was gradually coming over me. I felt as if all my energy was being sapped from me, and a deadly nausea was overpowering my senses. The Count went on uttering commonplaces, but his voice came from far away. I was conscious of his peculiar eyes gazing into mine. They grew larger and larger, and it seemed that I was looking into two wells of fire. And then, with a clumsy movement, I knocked my wine glass over. The frail thing shattered to fragments, and the noise restored me to my senses. A splinter pierced my hand, and a tiny pool of blood formed on the table. I sought for a handkerchief, but before I could produce it, I was terrified by an unearthly howl, which echoed through the vaulted hall. The cry came from the lips of the Count, and in a moment he was bending over the blood on the table, licking it up with obvious relish. A more disgusting sight I have never witnessed, and struggling to my feet, I made for the door. But terror weakened my limbs, and the Count had overtaken me before I had covered many yards. His white hands grasped my arms and led me back to the chair I had vacated. "My dear sir," he said, "I must beg you to excuse me for my discourtesy. The members of my family have always been peculiarly affected by the sight of blood. Call it an idiosyncrasy if you like, but it does at times make us behave like wild animals. I am grieved to have so far forgotten my manners as to behave in such a strange way before a guest. I assure you that I have sought to conquer this failing, and for that reason I keep away from my fellow men." The explanation seemed plausible enough, but it filled me with horror and loathing, more especially as I could see a tiny globule of blood clinging to his mouth. "I fear I'm keeping your excellency from bed," I suggested, "and in any case I think it is time I got back to the inn." "Oh, no, my friend," he replied. "The night hours are the ones I enjoy best, and I shall be very grateful if you will remain with me until morning. The castle is a lonely place, and your company will be a pleasant change. There is a room prepared for you in the south turret, and tomorrow, who knows, there may be other guests to cheer us." A deadly fear gripped my heart, and I staggered to my feet, stammering, "Let me go. Let me go. I must return to the village at once." "You cannot return tonight, for a storm is brewing, and the cliff path will be unsafe." As he uttered these words, he crossed to a window, and flinging it open, raised one arm toward the sky. As if in obedience to his gesture, a flash of vivid lightning split the clouds, and a clap of thunder seemed to shake the castle. Then the rain came in a terrible deluge, and a great wind howled across the mountains. The Count closed the casement and returned to the table. "You see, my friend," he chuckled, "the very elements are against your return to the village. You must be satisfied with such poor hospitality as we can offer you, for tonight at any rate." The red-rimmed eyes met mine, and again I felt my will being sapped from my body. His voice was no more than a whisper, and seemed to come from far away. "Follow me, and I will conduct you to your room. You are my guest for tonight." He took a candle from the table, and like a man in a trance, I followed him up a winding staircase, along an empty corridor, and into a cheerless room furnished with an ancient four-poster bed. "Sleep well," he said with a wicked leer. "Tomorrow night, you shall have other company." The heavy door slammed behind him as he left me alone, and I heard a bolt being shot on the other side. Summoning what little strength was left in my body, I hurled myself against the door. It was securely fastened, and I was a prisoner. Through the keyhole came the Count's purring voice. "Yes, you shall have other company tomorrow night. The lords of Kaldestein shall give you a hearty welcome to their ancestral home." A burst of mocking laughter died away in the distance as I fell to the floor in a dead faint. I must have recovered somewhat after a time and dragged myself to the bed, and again sunk into unconsciousness, for when I came around, daylight was streaming through the barred window of the room. I looked at my wristwatch. It was 3:30, and by the sun it was afternoon, so the greater part of the day had passed. I still felt weak, but struggled over to the window. It looked out upon the craggy slopes of the mountain, and there was no human habitation in sight. With a moan, I returned to the bed and tried to pray. I watched the patch of sunlight on the floor grow fainter and fainter until it had faded altogether. Then the shadows gathered, and at last only the dim outline of the window remained. The darkness filled my soul with a new terror, and I lay on the bed in a cold, clammy sweat. Then I heard footsteps approaching the door, which was flung open, and the Count entered, bearing a candle. "You must pardon me for what may seem shocking lack of manners on my part," he exclaimed, "but necessity compels me to keep to my chamber during the day. Now, however, I am able to offer you some entertainment." I tried to rise, but my limbs refused to function. With a mirthless laugh, he placed one arm around my waist and lifted me with as little effort as if I were a baby. In this fashion, he carried me across the corridor and down the stairs into the hall. Only 3 candles burned on the table, and I could see little of the room for some moments after he had dumped me into the chair. Then, as my eyes became accustomed to the gloom, I realized that there were 2 other guests at that board. The feeble light flickered on their faces, and I almost screamed with horror. I looked upon the ghastly countenance of dead men, every feature stamped with evil, and their eyes glowed with the same hellish light that shone in the Count's eyes. "Allow me to introduce my uncle and my cousin," said my jailer, "August von Kaldestein and Fyodor von Kaldestein." But I blurted out, "I was told that Count Fyodor died in 1645. The 3 terrible creatures laughed heartily, as if I had recounted a good joke. Then August leaned over the table and pinched the fleshy part of my arm. "He is full of good blood," he chuckled. "This feast has been long promised, Ludwig, but I think it has been worth waiting for." I must have fainted at that, and when I came to myself, I was lying on the table, and the 3 were bending over me. Their voices came in sibilant whispers. "The throat must be mine," said the Count. "I claim the throat as my privilege." "It should be mine," muttered August. "I'm the eldest, and it is long since I've fed. Yet I am content to have the breast." "The legs are mine," croaked the 3rd monster. "Legs are always full of rich red blood." Their lips were drawn back like the lips of animals, and their white fangs gleamed in the candlelight. Suddenly, a clanging sound disturbed the silence of the night. It was the castle bell. The creatures darted to the back of the dais, and I could hear them muttering. Then the bell gave a more persistent peal. "We are powerless against it," the Count cried. "Back to your retreat." His 2 companions vanished through the small door which led to the underground chapel, and the Count of Kaldestein stood alone in the center of the room. I raised myself into a sitting posture, and as I did so, I heard a strong voice calling beyond the main door. "Open in the name of God," it thundered. "Open by the power of the ever-blessed sacrament of the altar." As if drawn by some overwhelming force, the Count approached the door and loosened the bolt. It was immediately flung open, and there stood the tall figure of the parish priest, bearing aloft something in a silver box like a watch. With him was the innkeeper, and I could see the poor fellow was terrified. The 2 advanced into the hall, and the Count retreated before them. "Thrice in 10 years have I frustrated you by the power of God," cried the priest. "Thrice has the holy sacrament been carried into this house of sin. Be warned in time, accursed man. Back to your foul tomb, creature of Satan. Back, I command you." With a strange whimpering cry, the Count vanished through the small door, and the priest came over and assisted me from the table. The innkeeper produced a flask and forced some brandy between my lips, and I made an effort to stand. "Foolish boy," said the priest, "you would not take my warning, and see what your folly has brought you to." They helped me out of the castle and down the steps, but I collapsed before we reached the inn. I have a vague recollection of being helped into bed, and remember nothing more until I awakened in the morning. The priest and the innkeeper were awaiting me in the dining room, and we breakfasted together. "What is the meaning of it all, Father?" I asked after the meal had been served. "It is exactly as I told you," was the reply. "The Count of Caldensine is a vampire. He keeps the semblance of life in his evil body by drinking human blood. 8 years ago, a headstrong youth like yourself determined to visit the castle. He did not return within reasonable time, and I had to save him from the clutches of the monster. Only by carrying with me the body of Christ was I able to effect an entrance, and I was just in time. Then 2 years later, a woman who professed to believe in neither God nor the devil made up her mind to see the Count. Again, I was forced to bear the Blessed Sacrament into the castle, and by its power overcame the forces of Satan. Today, since I watched you climb the cliff and saw with relief that you returned safely. But yesterday morning, Heinrich came to inform me that your bed had not been slept in, and he was afraid the Count had got you. We waited until nightfall and then made our way up to the castle. The rest you know. I can never thank you more sufficiently for the manner in which you saved me from those creatures," I said. "Creatures?" repeated the priest in a surprised voice. "Surely there is only the Count. The servant does not share his master's blood loss." "No, I did not see the servant after he had admitted me. But there were two others, August and Feodor." "August and Feodor," he murmured. "Then it is worse than we have ever dreamed. August died in 1572 and Feodor in 1645. Both were monsters of iniquity, but I did not suspect they were numbered among the living dead." "Father," quavered the innkeeper, "we are not safe in our beds. Can we not call upon the government to rid us of these vampires?" "The government would laugh at us," was the reply. "We must take the law into our own hands." "What is to be done?" I asked. "I wonder if you have the courage to see this ghastly business through and to witness a sight that will seem incredible." I assured him I was willing to do anything to help, for I considered I had owed my life to him. Then he said, "I will return to the church for a few things, and we will go up to the castle. Will you come with us, Heinrich?" The innkeeper hesitated just a moment, but it was evident that he had the greatest confidence in the priest, and he answered, "Of course I will, Father." It was almost midday when we set off on our mysterious mission. The castle door stood wide open exactly as we had left it on the previous night, and the hall was deserted. We soon discovered the door under the tapestry, and the priest, with a powerful electric flashlight in his hand, led the way down the damp steps. At the chapel door he paused, and from his robes drew three crucifixes and a vessel of holy water. To each of us he handed one of the crosses and sprinkled the door with the water. Then he opened it, and we entered the cavern. With hardly a glance at the altar and its gruesome painting, he made his way to the entrance of the vault. It was locked, but he burst the catch with a powerful kick. A wave of fetid air leaped out at us, and we staggered back. Then lifting his crucifix before him and crying, "In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost," the priest led us into the tomb. I do not know what I expected to see, but I gave a gasp of horror as a light revealed the interior of the place. In the center, resting on a wooden bier, was the sleeping body of the Count of Caldensine. His red lips were parted in a smile, and his wicked eyes were half open. Around the vault, niches contained coffins, and the priest examined each in turn. Then he directed us to lift two of them to the floor. I noticed that one bore the name of August von Caldensine, and the other that of Feodor. It took all our united strength to move the caskets, but at last we had them down. And all the time the eyes of the Count seemed to be watching us, though he never moved. "Now," whispered the priest, "the most ghastly part of the business begins." Producing a large screwdriver, he began to prise off the lid of the first coffin. Soon it was loose, and he motioned us to raise it. Inside was Count August, looking exactly as I had seen him the previous night. His red-rimmed eyes were wide open and gleamed wickedly, and the stench of corruption hung about him. The priest set to work on the second casket, and soon revealed the body of Count Feodor, with his matted hair hanging about his white face. Then began a strange ceremony. Taking the crucifixes from us, the priest laid them upon the breast of the two bodies, and producing the breviary, recited some Latin prayers. Finally he stood back and flung holy water into the coffins. As the drops touched the leering corpses, they appeared to writhe in agony, to swell as though they were about to burst, and then before our eyes they crumbled into dust. Silently, we replaced the lids of the coffin and restored them to their niches. And now, said the priest, we are powerless. Ludwig von Kaldenstein, by evil arts, has conquered death, for the time being at any rate, and we cannot treat him as we have treated these creatures, whose vitality was only a semblance of life. We can but pray that God will curb the activities of this monster of sin. So saying, he laid the third cross upon the count's breast, and sprinkling him with holy water, uttered a Latin prayer. With that we left the vault, but as the door clanged behind us, something fell to the ground inside the place. It must have been the crucifix falling from the count's breast. We made our way up into the castle, and never did God's good air taste sweeter. All this time we had seen no sign of the old servant, and I suggested we should try to discover him. His quarters, I remembered, were on the north turret. There we found the crooked old body hanging by the neck from a beam in the roof. He had been dead for at least 24 hours, and the priest had said nothing could be done other than to notify his death to the proper quarter and arrange for the funeral to take place. I am still puzzled about the mystery of Kaldenstein Castle. The fact that Count August and Count Fedor had become vampires after death, although it sounds fantastic enough, is more easily understandable than Count Ludwig's seeming immunity from death. The priest could not explain the matter, and appeared to think that the Count might go on living and troubling the neighborhood for an indefinite period. One thing I do know. On that last night at Kaldenstein, I opened my window before retiring to bed and looked out upon the castle. At the top of one of the turrets, clear in the bright moonlight, stood a black figure, the shadowy form of the Count of Kaldenstein. Little more remains to be told. Of course, my stay in the village threw all my plans out. By the time I arrived back at Munich, my tour had taken nearly 20 days. Peter Schmidt laughed at me and wondered what blue-eyed maiden had caused me to linger in some Bavarian village. I didn't tell him that the real cause of the delay had been 2 dead men and a third who, by all natural laws, should have been dead long ago.